So what I'm going to do is, first of all, talk a little bit about the place of the teaching on the end in St. Thomas, the teaching on the end of the world, our end, our final end. That's what eschatology is, after all. And then get right to the topic of resurrection, in particular, our resurrection, which is closely related to Christ's resurrection, but in theology it is a distinct topic. First of all, eschatology in St. Thomas is not always obviously the first thing that's thought about when it comes to his teaching. But in fact, it's a central element of, I would say, his theology. It's in many ways profoundly eschatological. Precisely because of the way, I would say, that he makes use of Aristotelian philosophy. That is, Thomas's theology is suffused with a kind of reflection upon all of reality in some way, insofar as causality comes into play. That is, you don't get very far in St. Thomas without running into the four Aristotelian causes. And I notice Father Anselm already spoke to you about final cause and efficient cause and formal causality. I'm just talking about the one kind final causality. In a certain way, what Thomas offers in his theology is a kind of transformed Aristotelian teleology, or the science of ends, in which God himself is the end and the purpose of all. Now, where do we find all this teaching on eschatology? One of the reasons eschatology may be a kind of sleeper topic in St. Thomas is that he didn't finish his Summa Theologiae, as most of you probably know. So this is supposed to be this kind of very systematic work, and very systematic indeed it is. And he got, only so far. He got through the first part, then the two parts of the second part, and then got partway through the third part before he had his kind of moment at which he couldn't do anything more, and we're not exactly clear as to why that was the case, and there are many theories. But the point is, he sort of stopped writing at that midpoint when he was still considering the sacrament of penance, and so he didn't finish the treatise on sacraments, and there was to be this planned section on eschatology, the end, or the final end, and he never got there. But we do have plenty of his writing on these topics. First of all, of course, in his commentary on the sentences, which is an extensive work, roughly speaking about the length of the Summa Theologiae. It was a very early work of the kind of thing, a kind of one training to become a teacher of theology, a master in theology in those days. One would write this commentary on the sentences, and that is what he did there. And so one of his followers took pieces of that commentary on the sentences and sort of rearranged them at the end of the Summa Theologiae to make a kind of, to kind of fill out the parts that were missing. And so that's what the result is in the published versions of the Summa Theologiae is you'll see this supplement of the Summa Theologiae. So, I don't know, is that news to most of you, or some of you would know that already? But the thing you have to be careful of there is that the order of topics is not Thomas's. It's the topics that someone else sort of picked in order to fill out that work. In any case, that's a place where you can find this material, that so-called supplement. Also the Summa Contra Gentiles, a work that Thomas started and finished. The Compendium of Theology, which he did not finish, It was to have three parts. He finished the first part, but it's a part on faith. And that has a significant teaching on eschatological matters such as the resurrection and judgment, etc. And then there are bits and pieces scattered around various other works, such as the work on the power of God or De Potentia Dei, the commentaries on Scripture, and a lot of others. So he wrote many works on these themes and their themes, and they're found throughout his work in some way or another. I would say that, in my judgment, Thomas's eschatology is centered around two central themes. Well, we might say three. I might add one here of importance, especially for tomorrow. Resurrection and judgment. So particularly sort of speaking, especially eschatologically in terms of what happens last, resurrection seems to be the central theme, general resurrection. It's the first one in order. If you look at the Summa Contra Gentiles, the very first matter that comes up after Thomas is done treating the sacraments is resurrection. And this, there are a couple reasons for it, at least. One is it's a somewhat traditional placement in that Peter Lombard had treated resurrection first in the commentary, the sentences. And so the commentaries on the sentences followed that pattern to some degree. The commentaries on the sentences followed that pattern. But the Summa Contra Gentiles was a work of Thomas's own design, and yet he stuck with that order there. And it's my, judgment that I think he stays with it because it is so very clearly revealed. It's part of the revelation of Christianity that there is a promised resurrection. And St. Paul goes so far as to say, you know, if there's no resurrection from the dead, we are the most pitiable of men. The entire faith basically would be not worth anything if it weren't for that. So this is essentially what St. Paul says. So we have an extremely central topic here, and not one of little moment. And I'll say some reasons why as we go through. A second topic that's quite important that I won't talk as much about, but we'll talk a little bit more about tomorrow, is judgment, the final judgment. So when Thomas speaks about matters of eschatology, he will sometimes say things like, finally in this work, say in the Summa Theologiae, we'll talk about resurrection, judgment, and things of that nature. So he will speak of those two things as kind of central, pivotal issues. The third one that I think is important, but it's eschatological more from a kind of looking toward, the humans looking toward the end, is the theme of beatitude, which becomes very programmatic for Thomas. That is his theory that we're all made for happiness, that we're all made to be happy with God, and that this, in a sense, provides a kind of direction for our lives. But we'll get to that especially tomorrow. Today, especially then, resurrection. And I claim that, in a sense, resurrection brings together several dimensions of the human person, the way in which we are to be united with the divinity, even as Christ himself is a kind of union of the divine and the human. We are to somehow partake in the divine nature finally. The resurrection in some way shows that it's not just ourselves in our spiritual nature that is to be perfected, but we are also to be perfected fully bodily as well, so that it is not merely the soul that is to participate in beatitude, but in some way, even the body in its way will participate in the divine life. But this perfection, of course, is effected in and through Christ himself. He is the one who is to make us finally perfected. And he does so perfecting us, that is, even in our bodily nature. And so, too, that means that there must be a kind of context for us to be perfected. And so, in some way, creation itself, all creatures, even the subhuman creatures, they will in some way, participate in final perfection, although we'll talk a little bit about what that means as we go. And if any of you have pets, this always ends up being a question. So is my pet going to be with me in heaven? Well, we'll see about that. So as I say, in resurrection is united in some way a consideration of Christ, who he is for us, and who he is for us as creatures who live in the context of all creation. And also then regarding our human nature, both in its, social aspect or communal aspect, as well as the personal dimensions. I'll leave a lot of the matter about our the personal dimension to the second session. The first one, I'll speak more about the communal dimension. So, first of all, with regard to Christ. Now, Thomas's conception of the end affirms that God is the Lord of history. That is, he is the one who will bring the end about. It's not something that just happens to happen when the somehow the clock runs out. Rather, it is going to be brought about by God, by his own design, as a gift from God. And Thomas really speaks of the appearance of Christ in glory as that which indicates that that God is, in a sense, in charge of this. That it's when Christ appears in glory that the resurrection happens, that it is by Christ's power that the resurrection happens. He is the one who is to raise us up at the last day. So, now resurrection is something that does perfect us, okay? So it's, in that sense, suited to our nature. Given that we have been made with an immortal soul, we are suited to immortality, on the one hand. On the other hand, we're a composed creature, soul and body. And in that respect, we're not suited to immortality. We're, in fact, fallible. So we have this kind of, as it were, ambiguous kind of nature. On the one hand, there is an immortality given to us in the soul, but on the other hand, a kind of fallibility, a kind of weakness. We can't keep ourselves together, and so we do die and are mortal, and yet we survive death in some way, not as human persons, but as souls. So it is that God, through Christ's work, does something for us, promises something for us in resurrection, something that is good for us, that suits us, but that's also beyond what we can do for ourselves. And so it is that resurrection in some way, Thomas will say, can be naturally desired, but it can't be naturally attained. Now, I have an acquaintance who on social media recently, he's a let's say, former Christian acquaintance who, when the feast of Easter came up, was coming, it was this year, he said something to the effect that, well, you know, I celebrate resurrection also. I think that Christianity teaches something wonderful in resurrection, showing everyone their potential, that they the potential of the human being for life and something more than this life. Well, I would say that's in a sense half right. There is a kind of suitability that the resurrection has. We are, in a sense, made for something more. But we can't do it. I think it doesn't take a lot of imagination to come to the conclusion that we are not suited to raise ourselves. And certainly if that's not a Christian outlook to the question of resurrection. You know, you see in St. Paul speaking here and there of God raising Jesus from the dead. And sometimes to us who have a developed sense, certainly of not only the humanity, but the divinity of Jesus, you know, wonder, well, didn't he raise himself from the dead? And we see in St. John, you know, the statement that that he laid his life down and will lift it up again. Yes, but those statements are important in that they do teach us clearly that it's indeed by the divinity that Christ is raised. It's not some kind of human given potential that allows Jesus to raise himself from the dead. Rather, it's the divinity united to him. So, yes, resurrection is something that perfects us, but in a way that we cannot get to on our own. Now, I mention Christ's resurrection because he is the firstborn from the dead. There are important similarities, it's taught, and by St. Thomas, that that our resurrection is to share with his resurrection. Also some differences, but first, important similarities. And that becomes a principle of discernment, that we are to share in his resurrection, be conformed to him. You can look at Romans 6, verse 5, or Philippians 3, verses 10 and 11 to see how the kinds of texts that is based on, that belief is based upon. That is, that our resurrection is in some way to be like Christ's. One important manner in which it is to be similar is that Christ was dead for a period of time. There were those 3 days. So for him, this is reduced to the bare minimum. One was not necessarily considered dead except after 3 days. And so Christ met that criterion. And yet he did not want to delay his resurrection any more than necessary, and so rose quickly. We, too, are to be dead for a time. Thomas says, in this we may see that there is a way in which believers participate in Christ's death and are conformed to him. And so this is a kind of indication of the way in which we, too, are to be dead for a time, and so to be like Christ in his being dead for a time and being raised only later. At the same time, his resurrection is different from ours. Because he's the only begotten Son of God, of course, Christ's resurrection was, in a sense, the cause of our resurrection. And so his resurrection came before ours, which makes possible our coming to faith in his resurrection. But not only as a kind of as a kind of example, but even as a kind of exemplar. That is, he is the first fruits of those who will come to rise. And so, in a sense, through human nature itself rising in Jesus, he makes rising in him, he makes possible our resurrection in him. So it is unlike him, we continue to be subject to the punishment of death. And it's only when human nature is completely freed from the punishment of original sin that it will be completely restored. And so it is that resurrection awaits the last day. And this also gives God a chance to have mercy upon us, that is, to give us time to be converted and to be saved, as Thomas says. So in a way, we see how the resurrection of Christ gives this kind of direction to our lives, allows us to have a kind of hope in him. And so this promise of resurrection kind of orients our life. We saw in the gospel for today, in the old rite, the gospel for today was Peter and John at the empty tomb, and it says that they saw and believed, and only then saw and believed, because they had not understood the scriptures that he had to rise from the dead. And you can see that the apostles didn't understand well what resurrection was even going to be when they're coming down the mountain from the transfiguration. Jesus says the Son of Man must be suffer and be killed and rise on the third day. And they discussed among themselves what it means to rise from the dead. They didn't have a category from it. We're still thinking about what it means to rise from the dead, and becomes something we don't directly experience. So that's the first part on Christ. A second, I had mentioned the sort of effect of Christ's work on the subhuman creation, if you will, all of the cosmos, the way in which resurrection has to have a kind of context. And so it is that in Thomas's reflections on what is to become of the world at the end, he does so by considering profoundly the connection between the cosmos and humanity. First of all, for St. Thomas, he says that, in a way, all things were made for man. All things were made for humans. The motion of the heavenly bodies and the processes of generation and corruption in the world, in some way, all contribute to human flourishing and to the purpose of human generation. They lead to human generation, Thomas teaches, until all those who are to be among the just or the elect come into existence. Once that happens, there will be no more need for the worldly movements, and so the world will come to an end. So Thomas discerns in what has been revealed and by a kind of reflection on the end of the world, that is, what is its purpose, a reason for the world to come to the end. That is, once the full number of elect is reached, there will be no more need for generation and corruption. Now, the full number of the elect doesn't mean it's just a matter of reaching a certain threshold, like the odometer turning over. Okay, we've got 144,000, that's it, or 144 billion or whatever. That number is to be understood as every single person that God has intended to bring into existence, not simply a sort of raw agglomeration. So that's in a way. So that's in a way a way he makes sense of the doctrine on the end of the world. That is, once the movements of the world are no longer needed, they will simply stop. And so it's not only reproduction, generation, that for which the need comes to an end, but also the need for sustenance. Those who are to rise and corrupt are not going to have need for food anymore, because food is given to us so that we can maintain ourselves against the ravages of time, as it were, to make up for losses. And that won't be needed anymore, since we'll be incorrupt. So then these processes of generation and corruption will no longer be needed. So that's what's meant by the end of the world. But that's not the end of the story either. In some way, the world not only will cease its motion and corruption when the dead are raised, but will also be renewed. And why should it be renewed? Well, so that it may be suitable for glorified persons, and so that creatures may continue to provide manifestations of God to human senses. And this renewal is going to fulfill the desire of the just and reward them for their merit in Christ, of course. So it is that in St. Thomas's theology of the renewal of the world, you don't have one humans changed without also the world being changed. Now, the transformation of the world is not a natural result of humanity's change in status, and it's not even a natural tendency, as it were. He says that from the viewpoint of human reason, he doesn't see a reason why the heavenly motion would have to stop, although it was more a matter of simply leaving open the question. He did not settle that question from the point of reason. He thought that Revelation taught that, and of course, as we believe, Revelation teaches that the world had a beginning and will have a kind of end or perfection. He also thought it was allowable philosophically to believe that the world could have gone on indefinitely. But Revelation, in a sense, gives one a clearer grasp of why the world's motion might end, why it might have a not just a stoppage, but an end, a goal. And for properly theological reasons, Thomas teaches that the motion of the heavens will cease, that God will cause that in order to bring it to its perfection. Now, I haven't mentioned the animals so much. Thomas believes that only those creatures that have some kind of ordination to perpetuity will continue in perpetuity. And he doesn't see animals or plants as having such an ordination. He sees rather the elements having that kind of ordination, because that kind of ordering, there's something in themselves that lends themselves to going on forever. We could talk more about that if you want, but that's the way he saw the matter. So it is that we await the bodily resurrection, and this hope, in a way, carries with it a hope for a renewed world, or at least a kind of expectation for that. And so it is that we have a kind of way in which even our view of the whole world is affected by the promise of resurrection. This isn't something that simply affects us in a way that is isolated, but will affect all created beings. Finally, I'm going to mention just a few matters related to the, we might call the collective nature of humanity that are important to touch upon, because I'm going to talk about some other matters related to more what we might call personal aspects of humanity. But I want specifically to touch upon the kind of communal aspects, because sometimes they get overlooked when we look at the more personal dimensions, and we want to include them. Because for St. Thomas, the resurrection, and St. Thomas as an interpreter of course, of what has been revealed to us, the resurrection doesn't simply involve a kind of agglomeration of individual perfection, but even a kind of corporate or communal perfection. He even takes some time to comment on the notion that for the just, there will be a kind of a rejoicing at the simultaneity of the resurrection, as the joy of one increases the joy of others. He will say that the resurrection itself is to be a kind of communal or group event. The final end is something that's going to be manifest to all. That's one thing that the life with God that the saints now enjoy does not have. There's not a kind of, they're still hidden with Christ in God, as it were, right? There is to be, at the end, a kind of revelation when all is in all and all is open to all. The picture of the Last Judgment, Matthew 25, is of a kind of something that happens manifestly, publicly. This is part of the pain through which we now go, is the way in which many things remain obscure to us. We don't see all the good that has been done. We don't see. The comeuppance for evil that has been done. This is part of what judgment is going to affect for us, allowing all of this to be made fully manifest. And as a matter of fact, the body is that which makes community possible, in a sense, right? For St. Thomas, the souls don't really have a kind of natural way of communicating with one another. They can communicate in God because they're in God, but they are made to, as we know, St. Thomas teaches, all knowledge comes through the senses. But also communication is done ordinarily through the senses, the way we are made. And so there's a way in which the body, in some way, makes that community possible and will allow communion kind of full expression. Of course, I mentioned the communion of saints currently. Now, there is a kind of communion of saints. There are not merely individual saints with God, and they are connected with one another and in God, praying for us. Those in purgatory, in a sense, are being prayed for by the saints and by us, and so there are connections among us. But all of these connections are remain somewhat obscure until the end, when all is brought to light. And so there is this kind of way in which, in St. Thomas's view, there is this church in patria, there's also this church on the way, and the church suffering, all of which are participating in one common church, one that is not yet fully revealed to us. And so, just in conclusion, we can see how Thomas's teaching, you know, on resurrection in some way bring together a number of threads of our faith, the way in which Christ is the one who brings our perfection about, that our perfection is to be something that is in the larger context of all that God has created, all that God wants to bring to perfection. And this is a perfection that is going to be brought out not only for our individual selves, but ourselves as we are members of the body of Christ.
I was just wondering, you said bodies are like allow communication, but are you just talking about according to our natural way? Because the angels have communicated.
Yeah, the angels have a way of communicating, and but we have not been made. Our intellects aren't like angels. We have this kind of poor intellect in comparison to the angels. We weren't designed to be disembodied. So, angels were made to know things by, this is in St. Thomas's theory, by this kind of infused species. And that's the way they were made, so they're good at that, and they're also superior intellects. Our minds were not made for that. We can have infused knowledge, but for the way we were made, we're not very good at it. So we have a kind of confused kind of knowledge with our the universals that come into our intellect one way or the other.
So a quick follow up on that, just because I thought about, I was thinking about infused knowledge as you replied. Of course, in the tradition, the highest form of prayer is infused contemplation. So is it strictly speaking correct to say that none of us know what infused knowledge is like in this, even in this life?
Well, strictly speaking, probably not, no. But
right, okay.
but that's probably a different, you know, a different kind of.
So there might be people out there who
could
be.
Yeah.
We can go ask them.
Yeah, you don't have so that's really a good point. Yeah, it depends on how broad you draw out the notion of experience to include the contemplation, mystical experience.
Right.
Yeah, that's good. Check on that. Yes.
And a footnote. Okay, so I would think infused contemplation gives us a knowledge of God, right? I mean, it connects us with God, but not necessarily with other minds, which would be more the kind of communicative aspect that we have.
Yeah, I guess I was just talking about the experience of infused knowledge as such, of anything.
Sure.
Right, and through that, we can have some knowledge that might not be otherwise available to us, even other minds, but only to the extent that God gives it to us.
Right.
Yeah, so I was wondering if you could say more about this order of perpetuity that apparently, because I was a little confused about
okay,
why.
Okay, we're talking about Fido now?
Well.
Pets? Well, or you want.
Well, sorry, okay. I guess I'm a little confused about what exactly Thomas thinks is still there in the new creation, and why just that, right? So, like, why the elements but not animals and plants? Because you'd think, I mean, on the one hand, you might think, well, animals and plants, yeah, they perish and are generated, but then so are elements, and they also, you know, yes, they're ordered to us, but then so are the elements, and, you know, you might think that all of the lower creation in addition to like helping us survive and stuff, also reflects the glory of God in its own kind of unique way. I'm not exactly sure why he thinks why no animals and plants, but yes, elements.
Yeah. So, he thinks that of all the created things, that the elements, are the ones that just go on. You understand. So this is his cosmology, right? So the philosophical reflection of that involved in Thomas's conception of the world is very much worth taking on board and thinking about. The scientific details are sometimes obsolete, right? So he conceives of every single thing as some combination of the four elements, right? So that's the cosmology at work there. So corruption, when corruption happens, as I understand it, I'm not really an expert on Thomas's cosmology, I'd have to say, this kind of ancient way of thinking about things. But the way I understand it, that the reason that things, that he would say that things would tend toward corruption is just what we would call a kind of probability of failure, because you have in every single thing, real thing, there's some kind of combination of the four elements. So because you have two things joined, not essentially joined, but simply joined in some particular here and there, there's a what we call a probability, or there's a likelihood that eventually it's that union is going to fail and dissolve. But the elements are still there, and it's sort of something like what we would call a law of conservation of matter, right? Where you always understand something comes from something else. You don't have stuff just suddenly appearing, and you don't have stuff just suddenly just disappearing. What you have is things combine in different ways, and what you end up with at the end of a process is just some new combination of the stuff that you had before. And that's what Thomas sees. But the things that go on are the elements. And so that's the order of perpetuity that they have. They seem to be something that has that, which animals don't have. He will say that the way, so all things are supposed to imitate God and do in some way. The way animals do this is by perpetuating the species. So the species tends to go on. Some people have said, so sort of extrapolating from Thomas, let's put it that way, the most plausible kinds of explanations I've heard, or let's say theorizings on this level, would be those who would suggest that it's possible that animals, even plants, even landscapes and accidental arrangements of things that might have some kind of special relation to a saint. And by that I don't mean someone who's necessarily exceptional, but someone who's found among the just, that there might be some way in which that being could survive based on their sort of relation to one who is saved and such. What I would wonder about, and so just suggest as a point of reflection, when a question like this comes up, well, let's leave it at that. Do you want to follow up in some way?
Well, yes. Yeah. It's unclear to me. I see there's a sense in which the elements are always there. It's unclear to me why that's the right criterion for what should still be there after the resurrection. And the other thing I would say would be,
well, the reason that's a criterion is that what God is doing, it's grace perfecting nature, right? So it should. And Thomas even says that we've heard the dictum that grace does not destroy nature, but perfect, elevates it and perfects it. Right. So this is classic for Saint Thomas and an understanding of his of his theology. He also says in a few places, glory does not destroy nature, but perfects it. Even the state of glory is not a kind of adding something that is so beyond nature that it's no longer the same thing. So there should be something there that's being elevated, I guess, would be the question. And I would just note that, you know, usually the objection or the thought from the side of those who would want to see animals in heaven, and some part of me, you know, said, well, why not? Why can't they be there too? And in the new heavens and new earth, let's say. It usually comes from our relation to them, right? That we want to see them there. Most of us don't say they want to be there. You know, my bulldog Hugo, when I was a kid, that Hugo wanted to be immortal. I don't see it. So it's in some way there can be a kind of projection onto animals as to, you know, the way we are versus the way they are.
I have no like particular attachment to any animals that would make me want them to be.
Yeah.
I don't really see what the objection is, because I don't to them being there because I don't see. I guess the other thing is on the elements, at least on Aristotle's view, and I assume Aquinas has the same view. It's usually a safe assumption. The elements are good. You know, they generate and corrupt out of each other. There's a constant cycle of generation and corruption of elements out of each other.
Yeah.
Does that stop for Thomas in the subjection?
Yeah.
So that they become stable?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he says this anywhere, but I could imagine, you know, like exceptions could happen. So it's not as if sort of God's hands become tied, but there's no more reason for there to be a generation corruption. In fact, you know, the motion of the heavens that causes all the generation corruption, that's all stopped as well.
And the reason why generation corruption has to stop is?
Well, there's no more reason for it. It's not needed.
Why? And it's not needed because?
Because all the elect are brought to life. And,
I can see that gives you a reason why, purely for the purposes of, like, sustaining human life.
Yeah.
But it seems like that's not the only reason for the existence of non-human beings.
Well, I mean, it seems like that, and in fact, that's an interesting way in which Thomas's thought develops a little bit. He actually will admit that, certainly all creatures are made for God.
Right. Exactly.
He starts out very strongly saying that all creatures are made for man. He allows for, though, in a certain way, the things themselves having their own kind of status, although they're subordinate,
right,
to humans. But he does recognize so that, you know, in a way, he takes seriously the givenness of their existence from God. They're not purely to serve us necessarily. Although strains of that remain in his thought, right, in my understanding. So I can see where you're going, saying, Possibly the thought could be drawn out there that perhaps their purpose isn't exhausted by their service to humanity. And that could be a way you could draw out that kind of possibility latent in Thomas's thought.
This is a little bit of a different direction. Thinking about the gospel accounts of the risen Lord, two things that are particularly striking to me are that the Lord still has the wounds of the crucifixion in his body, and that people who were very close to him have trouble recognizing him. Can you talk a little bit about what those two things may mean for our own for our bodies? bodies or for our communities, or if St. Thomas has any comments on those things?
So there's deep reflection on that, I would say. With regard to the wounds, and in the tradition even further, but with regard to the wounds, well, first of all, that the resurrection is not a statement that, Christ's resurrection is not a statement that all is forgotten, or that, you know, this is, there's a difference between, he is the crucified one who is risen. So, so Thomas, for example, will speak of the merits of Christ raised and seated at the right hand of the Father, interceding for us, being indicated by those wounds. In other words, it's a part of it's a there isn't a kind of it's also partly a kind of indication that. We're not stuck in a kind of an endless cycle. I mean, this is the coming to us is a once and for all effecting of our salvation, and his wounds, in a sense, show us that he has been through suffering and death, and has come out the other side, and so intercedes for us with the Father, with bearing the wounds in his body. So, an indication of his merit, and then through our connection with him, being able to merit as well. The second part was about
not being recognized.
Oh yeah, well yeah, that is. There are a few things one could say about that. I'm not sure that St. Thomas would say all these things. I mean, for one thing, they don't recognize him in different ways, right? Depending on the account. So he's a gardener or a ghost. So when he's really ordinary, or he's something really strange and extraordinary. You could talk about just expectations. You don't expect to see somebody who's dead alive again. So that could be an element. There is an element, too, in the Gospels where seeing isn't believing. It's not enough to see the risen Lord. He has to somehow reveal himself and want to be recognized too, and also to give the gift, I think, of faith. So there's a lot on that. I'm not sure how much is in Thomas on that. I haven't looked with that in mind, but I could imagine you could find something there. For example, with St. Thomas, the apostle, who you know, Jesus says to him, do not be disbelieving, but believe. This is after he's showing him himself. And that I think in Thomas Aquinas' commentary on that moment, that he comments on the statement, my Lord and my God, is a statement of faith, which goes beyond just, it's not just merely the empirical proof that gives him knowledge. He has to still make a confession of faith.